Harry stood.
You motherfucking scumbag piece of shit.
Excuse me?
Shove it up your ass. I'm walking the fuck out of here.
He reached for his things on Maddox's desk and an explosion of pain ripped through the right side of his body. He heard a crashing sound and a thump, then nothing. He realized he was lying on the floor and a cold sweat covered his body. His eyes were blurry, but he could see Carl standing over him, tapping the cattle prod into his palm as if to say, "You want another jolt?" Harry tried to stand, but his legs were rubbery. The other guard got behind him, lifted him under his arms, and dropped him back into his chair. Harry tried to steady his breathing and his quivering muscles. His eyes were still unfocused, and everything sounded tinny in his ears. One of the guards gave him a plastic bottle of water, which he could barely hold. Mr. Maddox said, "It's amazing what electricity can do to a person. And there's almost no visible evidence."
Where were we?
Harry tried to say, "Fuck you," but couldn't get the words out.
"I think you were trying to convince me that you were on a routine assignment looking for IRA training camps."
"I'm not convinced." Harry took a deep breath and said,
"It's true."
"Well then, let me reassure you, there are no members of the Irish Republican Army on my property. In fact, Mr. Muller, my ancestry is English through and through, and I have no fondness for the IRA. Harry didn't reply. Maddox said, "Okay, let's cut the IRA crap and go right to the heart of this matter. What exactly do your superiors think is going on here?" Again, Harry didn't respond.
"Do you need electrical encouragement to answer my question?"
"No, I don't know. They didn't tell me anything. But they must have said something like, 'Harry, we suspect that the Custer Hill Club is—'
what?
How did they characterize this place and its members?"
"This is really important to me, and I want you to tell me."
"You're going to tell me now or later. Now is easier." Harry tried to clear his head from the electrical jolt and think about his situation. He'd never been on the wrong side of an interrogation desk, and he'd never had the experience or training that would guide him in a situation like this.
"Mr. Muller?"
He couldn't figure out if he should stick to the IRA story or if he should just tell this bastard the little he knew. The goal, obviously, was to get out of here alive, though he could hardly believe that his life was in danger.
"Mr. Muller?"
"We did bird watching, then the IRA, which is actually a good story, but not the true story. You seem a bit confused, so let me help you. You were told that the Custer Hill Club was made up of a bunch of rich, old, right-wing crazies who were conspiring to do something that may be illegal, correct?" Harry nodded. "What else did they tell you about us?"
"Nothing. I have no need to know."
"Ah, yes. Need to know. Did they mention that several of our members are very highly placed and influential people in society and government?" Harry shook his head.
"I have no need to know that."
"Well, I think you do need to know. That's why you're here, whether you know it or not. Fact is, the members of this club hold a lot of power. Political power, financial power, and military power. Did you know that one of our members is the Deputy Secretary of Defense? Another is a top national security advisor to the President. Did you know that?" Harry shook his head. "We don't appreciate some government agency conducting an illegal surveillance of our activities, which are entirely legal. We hunt, fish, drink, and discuss the world situation. The Constitution itself protects our right to assemble, to free speech, and to privacy, correct?" Harry nodded. Someone in your agency has overstepped his bounds, and that person will be made to answer for his actions. Again, Harry nodded. He believed Maddox. This wouldn't be the first time one of his bosses screwed up and ordered surveillance on some group or some person who wasn't guilty of anything. On the other hand, that's what surveillance was for, to see if a suspicion of criminal activity was accurate or justified. Harry said, I think they screwed up. Oh, I know they did. And you just got caught in the middle. Right. You're not an FBI agent? Oh. Or a CIA officer? Hell no. You're, what, a contract agent? Yeah, retired NYPD, working for the FBI. Low level, suggested Mr. Maddox. Well, yeah. I'll make sure you're not punished. Yeah, and thanks for the jolt. I don't know what you're talking about. Mr. Maddox checked his watch and said, I'm expecting company. He stared at Harry. Did you know I was expecting company? No. You just happened to be here on this particular day? Harry didn't answer. Talk to me, Mr. Mueller. I have a busy morning. Well, I was told to see if anyone... You were told to observe arriving guests, photograph them, take down their license plate numbers, note their arrival times, and so forth. Yeah. How did these people you work for know there was a meeting here today? I have no idea. Why did you take a photograph of my utility pole? Just saw it, ran into it. When did you get here? Last night. Is anyone with you? No. How did you get here? I drove my camper up, Harry replied. And these are the keys? Yeah. Where is the camper? On the Logan Road south of here. Near where you entered the property? Yeah. Are you supposed to make a telephone report? He wasn't, but he replied, yes. When? When I leave this property. I see. Maddox picked up Harry's cell phone and turned it on. I see you have a message. He added, in case you wondered why you have such good service here in the middle of nowhere, I have my own cell phone relay tower. He gestured toward the window. Now you know what that tower is, and you can label your photograph. You can also indicate that it has a voice scrambler so that no one can listen to my calls. He asked Harry, isn't it nice to be rich? I wouldn't know. What's your voicemail code? Harry gave it to him and Maddox dialed voicemail, punched in the code, and put the phone on speaker. Laurie said, hi, honey. Got your message. I was sleeping. I'm going shopping today with your sister and Anne. Call me later. I'll have my cell with me, okay? Let me know if you have to stay over. I love you, and I miss you. She added, be careful of those right-wing loonies. They like their guns. Take care. Maddox commented, she sounds very nice. Except for that part about the right-wing loonies and the guns. He observed, she apparently thinks you may be staying here overnight. She may be right. He turned off the power to the cell phone and said to Harry, I guess you know these things send off a signal that can be tracked. Yeah, that's my job. That's right. Amazing technology. I can call my children any time, any place. Of course, they never answer, but they call back after 5 messages or when they need something. Harry forced a smile. So, said Mr. Maddox, you seem to be who and what you say you are. To be quite honest, Mr. Mueller, I thought you might be an agent of a foreign power.
What?
I'm not being paranoid. The people who are members of this club have enemies around the world. The right kind of enemies. We are all patriots, Mr. Mueller, and we've caused some problems for the enemies of America around the globe.
That's good.
I thought you'd agree. And these same people are your enemies. So, to use an old Arabic expression, the enemy of my enemy is my friend.
Right.
Sometimes, however, the enemy of my enemy is also my enemy. Not because he wants to be, but because we have a difference of opinion about how to deal with our common enemy. But that's a discussion for another time.
Yeah, I'll call you next week.
Bane Maddox stood, looked at his watch, and said, I'll tell you what. Since you and your agency seem so interested in this club and its members, I'm going to do something that I've never done before. I'm going to allow you, an outsider, to sit in on the executive board meeting, which will take place this afternoon after a welcome lunch for our arriving club members. Would you like to join us?
No, not really.
I thought you were here to get information. What's your rush?
No rush, but
I'll even let you take pictures.
Thanks, but I think your presence at this meeting can do both of us some good.
You'll learn something, and I'll get to see your reaction to what we're discussing. Sometimes we get into this bunker mentality, you know, where outside reality is excluded, and only our reality is heard. That's not healthy.
Harry didn't reply, and Bane Maddox warmed to his idea.
I want you to feel free to comment, to tell us if we're sounding like a bunch of crazy old fools, right-wing loonies. He grinned. We need your honest opinion about our next project. Project Green.
What's Project Green?
Mr. Maddox glanced at the security guards, then went over to Harry and whispered in his ear,
Nuclear Armageddon.
Chapter 5. Harry Mueller was led, blindfolded and barefoot, down two flights of stairs into what must have been the basement of the lodge. It was cold and damp, and he could hear sounds of mechanical and electrical motors. He heard a door open, then he was prodded forward. The door slammed shut, and he heard a metal bolt sliding. He stood there, then said,
Hey, you. You there?
Silence. He listened a while, then pulled the blindfold off and looked around. He was alone. Harry stood in a small room walled with concrete blocks painted the same gray enamel as the concrete floor. The low ceiling was covered with corrugated metal. As his eyes adjusted to the glaring light of an overhead fluorescent fixture, he saw that the room held only a steel bed, which was bolted to the floor. On the bed was a thin mattress, on which were his camouflage shirt and pants, which he put on. He checked his pockets, but they hadn't given him anything back. In a corner of the room were a toilet and a sink. The toilet had no seat and no water tank, just like in a prison cell. The sink had no mirror over it, not even the plastic or steel mirrors they used in jail. He went to the steel door that had no handle and no window and pushed on it, but it didn't budge. He searched the room, looking for anything that he could use as a weapon, but it was completely bare, except for the bed and a rusty radiator that wasn't putting out much heat. He noticed now a small swivel eyeball camera mounted in the corner of the ceiling, with a recessed speaker beside it. He stuck up his middle finger and shouted, Fuck you! No one replied. He looked around for something that he could use to smash the camera and the speaker, but there wasn't a single loose item in the room except for himself. He took a running start, jumped, and smacked the camera with his hand. The camera continued sweeping the room. Then a shrill, high-decibel sound pierced the room, and Harry covered his ears and backed away from the speaker. The painful noise continued, and Harry shouted, "Okay! Okay!" The sound stopped, and a voice said, "Sit."
"Fuck you, bastards. Wait until I get out of here."
He had lost track of time, but he figured it must be about 10 or 11 in the morning. His stomach growled, but he didn't feel particularly hungry. Only thirsty, and he had to pee. He walked to the toilet and a camera followed him. He urinated, then went to the sink and turned on the single tap. A trickle of cold water ran into the basin. He washed up, then used his hands to drink from the faucet. There was no towel, and he wiped his hands on the side of his pants. He went back to the bed and sat. He thought about his conversation with Bane Maddox. Nuclear Armageddon. He said to himself, what the hell is that asshole talking about? And what was this meeting that he was invited to? None of this made too much sense unless this was all a setup. He stood. That's it. This is one of those stupid training camps. Holy shit! He thought about the whole assignment, from his 10 minutes in Tom Walsh's office, to the tech guy, to cutting through the fence, to the guards, to this prison cell in a private house. This whole thing was a test. One of those SERE courses. Survival, evasion, resistance, and escape. Well, he definitely didn't pass the evasion part, which was why he was in the cell. He went over in his mind the interrogation from the guy named Maddox. The resistance part. Oh, shit. Did I blow that? What the hell did I say? I told him to go fuck himself and stuck to my cover. Then I did the IRA rap, which was smart, right? He thought about the cattle prod. Would they do that?
Yeah, maybe.
And later, there'd be the escape thing, then the evasion thing again, and survival in the woods. Yeah, that's where this is going. He replayed everything in his mind, slanting it toward his new belief that this was some crazy FBI or CIA thing. It had to be. This was just too weird otherwise. They had their eye on him for something big, and this was the big test. They did this kind of thing to see what you could take. The Custer Hill Club was like the CIA farm in Virginia, right? He said to himself, okay, good. I passed the first test. Now, we do the meeting and see what that's all about. Keep cool, Harry. Stay pissed. He shouted at the camera, assholes! I'm gonna rip your fucking heads off and shit down your necks! He lay back on the thin mattress and smiled to himself. He yawned and drifted into a restless sleep. The glare of the overhead light and the cold made him dream that he was outside again, walking through the woods. He was taking pictures of birds. Then he was arguing with some men. Then he was talking pleasantly to Mr. Maddox, who gave him back his gun and said, you're going to need this. The men suddenly raised their rifles, and dogs were running toward him. He pulled the trigger on his Glock, but it didn't fire. Harry sat up quickly and wiped the cold sweat from his face. Holy shit. He fell back on the bed and stared up at the metal ceiling. Something was bothering him. It was Maddox. Something about that guy seemed too real. No, can't be real. Because if this was all real, then his life was in danger. The door opened, and a voice said, come with us. Part 3. Saturday, North Fork, Long Island. If love is the answer, could you rephrase the question? Lily Tomlin. Chapter 6. Kate and I got to the bed and breakfast in the hamlet of Matatuck before the lockout time of 10 p.m. and checked in with the proprietor, a lady who reminded me of the nice matrons who work in the Metropolitan Correctional Center downtown. The quaint old house was everything I expected and more. In fact, it sucked. We slept late Saturday morning, so we missed the home-cooked breakfast, and also missed meeting the other guests, two of whom we'd heard through the thin walls the night before. The woman was a screamer, but not multi-orgasmic, thank God. Anyway, we spent Saturday touring the North Fork vineyards, which have replaced the potato farms that I remember from when I was a kid. The vines are mature now and produce fine Chardonnays, Merlots, and so forth. We sipped a little free wine at each of the vineyards, and I especially enjoyed the Sauvignon Blancs, which were dry and fruity, with a hint of, well, potatoes. Saturday night, we went to a floating barge restaurant, which had a great view of Peconic Bay and was very romantic, as per Kate. We sat at the bar while we waited for our table, and the bartender rattled off a dozen local wines that were available by the glass. Kate and the bartender, a young fellow who looked like he could benefit from a few weeks of man camp, discussed the whites and settled on one that wasn't too fruity. I thought grapes were a fruit. The young man asked me, "Did any of those wines sound good to you?" "They all did. I'll have a bud." He processed that, then got our drinks. There was a stack of newspapers on the bar, and I noticed the New York Times headline. Pentagon plans smallpox shots for up to 500,000. The invasion looked like a done deal, unless Saddam knuckled under. I considered calling my bookie to see what today's odds were for going to war. I should have placed a bet last week, when the odds were longer. But I have inside information, so that's cheating. Also, it's not ethical to make money on a war, unless you're a government contractor. I asked Kate, who's a lawyer, "Am I a government contractor or a contract agent for the government?"
"Why do you ask?"
"I'm struggling with an ethical issue."
"That's probably not much of a struggle."
"Be nice. I'm thinking of calling my bookie and placing a bet on the Iraq war."
"You have a bookie?"
"Yeah. Don't you?"
"No. That's illegal."
"Am I under arrest? Can we do the thing with the handcuffs later?" She tried not to smile and glanced around the bar.
"Lower your voice."
"I'm trying to be romantic." The hostess came over and escorted us to our table. Kate studied the menu and asked if I'd split a dozen oysters with her, reminding me with a grin,
"They're an aphrodisiac."
I informed her, "Not really. I had a dozen last week and only 11 worked." I added, "Old joke."
"It better be."
Seafood was the specialty of the house, so I ordered Long Island duck. They swim, right? I was feeling relaxed and happy to be away from the stress of job and the city. I said to Kate, "This was a good idea."
"We needed to get away."
I had a brief thought of Harry in upstate New York, and I wanted to ask Kate again about the Custer Hill Club, but the purpose of being here was to leave the job behind. Kate was in charge of the wine menu, and after some fascinating discussion with the waiter, she ordered a bottle of something red. It came, and she tasted it, pronouncing it full-bodied with the hint of plum, which would go well with my duck. I didn't think my duck cared. Anyway, she raised her glass and said, "To beepers that don't go off on weekends." "Amen." We clinked glasses and drank. Hers must have had the plum. I held the wine glass to the candlelight and said, "Nice sleeve."
"Nice what?"
"Cuffs." She rolled her eyes. So we had a nice dinner in pleasant surroundings, and Kate's beautiful blue eyes sparkled in the candlelight, and the red wine made me feel all warm and fuzzy.
It was easy to pretend that all was right with the world. It never is, of course, and never was, but you have to steal a few hours now and then and pretend that the rest of the world isn't going to hell. On that subject, everyone I know still talks about how their lives have changed since September 11th, and it's not all for the worse. A lot of people, myself included, and Kate too, sort of woke up and said, it's time to stop sweating the small stuff. It's time to reconnect to people you like and get rid of people you don't like. We're not dead, so we need to live. My father, who was a World War II veteran, once tried to describe to me the mood of the country after Pearl Harbor. He's not good with words, and he was having some difficulty painting a picture of America on that first Christmas after December 7th, 1941. Finally, he got it and said, we were all scared, so we drank and fucked a lot. And we called and visited people we hadn't seen in a while, and people sent lots of cards and letters, and everybody came closer together and helped each other, so it really wasn't that bad. Then he asked me, why did we need a war to do that? Because, Pop, that's the way we are. And on September 11th, last year, my parents spent 2 days trying to reach me from Florida. And when they finally got through to me, they spent 15 minutes telling me how much they always loved me, which was a bit of a surprise, but I'm sure they meant it. And that's the way we are now. But in a year or two, lacking another attack on the country, we'll be back to our normal, self-centered, standoffish selves. And that's okay, too. Because quite frankly, I'm getting a little tired of out-of-town friends and family asking me how I'm doing. We've all had our cathartic moment and our re-evaluation of our lives, and it's time to get on with whatever we were doing and go back to being whoever we were. I do, however, like the excessive drinking and fucking thing, and we should hold on to that a while longer. My bachelor friends tell me, well, that's another topic for another time. Meanwhile, I said to Kate, I love you. She reached across the table and took my hand. I love you too, John. And that's one good thing that came out of that day, just over a year ago. I wasn't the most attentive husband on September 10th, but the next day, when I thought she was dead, my world collapsed with those towers. And when I saw her alive, I realized I needed to say I love you more often, because in this business and in this life, you never know what's going to happen tomorrow. Part 4. Saturday, upstate New York. Power always thinks it has a great soul and vast views beyond the comprehension of the weak, and that it is doing God's service when it is violating all his laws. John Adams. Chapter 7. Harry Muller sat blindfolded, with his ankles shackled, in what felt like a comfortable leather chair. He smelled burning wood and cigarette smoke. He could hear people speaking in low tones, and he thought he heard Bane Maddox's voice. Someone slid the blindfold down around his neck, and as his eyes adjusted to the light, he saw that he was sitting at the end of a long pine table. Also sitting at the table were 5 other men, 2 on each side, and at the head of the table, facing him, was Bane Maddox. The men were speaking to one another as if he wasn't there. In front of each man were legal pads, pens, water bottles, and coffee cups. Harry noticed a keyboard in front of Maddox. He looked around the room, which was a library or a den. The fireplace was to his left, flanked by 2 windows whose drapes were drawn so that he couldn't see out, but he knew from his blindfolded walk from his cell that he was on the ground floor. Standing near the door were Carl and another security guard. They were wearing holstered pistols, but not carrying cattle prods.
He now noticed a very big black leather suitcase sitting upright in the middle of the floor. It was an old suitcase, strapped to a wheeled caddy. Bane Maddox seemed to notice him for the first time and said, "Welcome, Mr. Muller. Coffee? Tea?" Harry shook his head. Maddox said to the other four men, "Gentlemen, this is the man I told you about. Detective Harry Muller, NYPD, retired. Currently working for the Federal Anti-Terrorist Task Force. Please make him feel welcome." Everyone acknowledged their guest with a nod. Harry thought two of the guys looked familiar. Maddox continued, "As you know, gentlemen, we have a few friends on the task force, but apparently none of them was aware that Mr. Muller was going to drop in today." One of the men said, "We'll need to look into that." The others nodded in unison. Harry tried to see through this bullshit, to reinforce his hope that this was an elaborately staged test. But somewhere in the back of his mind, this hope was fading, though he clung to it. Maddox motioned to the guards, who left the room. Harry looked at the men along the table. Two were about Maddox's age, one was older, and the one to his right was younger than the rest. They all wore blue blazers and casual plaid shirts like Maddox, as though this were the uniform of the day. Harry focused on the two men who looked familiar. He was sure he'd seen them on TV or in the newspapers. Maddox noticed Harry's stare and said, "Forgive me for not formally introducing my executive board." One of the men interrupted, "Bane, names are not necessary." Maddox replied, "I think Mr. Muller recognizes a few of you anyway." No one responded, except Harry. "I don't need any names." "You need," said Maddox, "to know what august company you are in." Maddox indicated the man to his immediate right, the oldest person in the room and the one who had made the objection. "Harry, this is Paul Dunn, advisor to the President on matters of national security and a member of the National Security Council, whom you probably recognize." Maddox turned to the person sitting next to Dunn, near Harry, and said, "This is General James Hawkins, United States Air Force and a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, whom you may also recognize, though Jim is a low-profile guy." Maddox indicated the man to his left. "This is Edward Wolfer, the Deputy Secretary of Defense, who likes the cameras. Never stand between Ed and a news camera or you'll get knocked over." Maddox smiled, but no one else did. Maddox added, "Ed and I graduated from Infantry Officer Candidate School together, Fort Benning, Georgia, April 1967. We served in Vietnam at the same time. He's made quite a name for himself since then, while I've made a lot of money." Wolfer didn't smile at what Harry thought must be an old joke by now. Maddox continued, "And to your right, Harry, is Scott Lansdale of the Central Intelligence Agency, who is definitely camera-shy, and who is also the CIA liaison to the White House." Harry glanced at Lansdale. He seemed a little cocky and arrogant, like most of the CIA guys Harry had had the misfortune to work with. Maddox said, "This is the executive board of the Custer Hill Club. The rest of our members, about a dozen men this weekend, are hiking or bird hunting, which I hope doesn't upset you." He explained to the other men, "Mr. Muller is a bird watcher." Harry wanted to say, "Fuck you," but remained silent. He understood now that the guys in this room had not come here from Washington to participate in a test of Harry Muller's qualifications for a bigger and better job. Maddox told Harry, "This holiday weekend was to be a regularly scheduled gathering to discuss world affairs, to exchange information, and to just enjoy some camaraderie. But your presence here has made it necessary for me to call this emergency meeting of the executive board.
I'm sure that means nothing to you now, but it will later.
Harry said, I don't want to hear any of this.
I thought you were a detective.
He stared at Harry and said, I've had a little time to check you out with our friends in the ATTF, and you appear to be who you say you are.
Harry didn't reply, but he wondered who Maddox's friends were in the ATTF.
Mr. Maddox informed him, if you were an FBI agent or CIA, we'd be very concerned.
Scott Lansdale, the CIA man, said, Bane, I can assure you that Mr. Mueller is not a CIA officer.
Maddox smiled.
I suppose it takes one to know one.
Lansdale continued, and I'm fairly certain that Mr. Mueller is not FBI. He is what he appears to be, a cop working for the FBI on surveillance.
Thank you for that assurance, said Maddox.
You're welcome. Now, I'd like some assurance, Bane. You weren't very clear about when Mr. Mueller will be reported as missing in action.
Maddox replied, Ask Mr. Mueller. He's right next to you.
Lansdale turned to Harry.
When do they start wondering where you are?
No lies. I know how they work at 26 Fed, and what I don't know, I can find out.
Harry thought, typical CIA bastard. Always pretending they know more than they actually know.
Harry replied, Well then, find out yourself.
Lansdale resumed without comment, like a trained interrogator, Will anyone call you?
How do I know? I'm not psychic.
Maddox interjected, I'm checking his cell phone and beeper every half hour or so.
The only message was from Lori. That's his girlfriend.
I'll send her a text message later from Mr. Mueller's cell phone.
Lansdale nodded. God forbid anyone on the task force would interrupt their holiday weekend.
He asked Harry, When are you supposed to get back to 26 Fed?
When I get there.
Who gave you this assignment?
Walsh or Parisi?
Harry thought this guy knew too much about the task force. He replied, I get my orders on an audio tape that self-destructs.
Me too.
What did your audio tape say, Harry?
I already answered that. IRA surveillance.
That's really lame.
Lansdale said to the others, Mr. Mueller's assignment probably came from Washington, and in the hallowed tradition of intelligence work, no one tells anyone more than someone thinks they need to know. That, unfortunately, is how 9/11 happened. Things have changed, but old habits are hard to break, and sometimes they're not bad habits. Mr. Mueller, for instance, can't tell us what he doesn't know. He added, I'm fairly sure we're okay for at least 48 hours. His girlfriend will probably miss him long before his supervisor does. He addressed Harry. Is she connected to law enforcement or to the intelligence business in any way?
Yeah, she's a CIA officer. Former prostitute.
Lansdale laughed.
I think I know her.
Maddox said, Thank you, Scott, for your assistance. He said to Harry, Your visit here, even as a low-level surveillance person, has given us some concern.
Harry didn't reply but looked around at the other men, who did seem a little concerned about something.
Maddox continued, However, some good may come of this. We've been planning a long time for Project Green, and I'm afraid that the planning has become procrastination. This often happens when a momentous decision needs to be made. He stared at his executive board, two of whom nodded and two of whom seemed annoyed.
Maddox went on, Harry, I think that your physical presence in this room is a strong reminder that there are forces in the government that are too curious about who we are and what we're doing. I think time has run out.
He looked at the other four men, who nodded, almost reluctantly.
Maddox said, So, gentlemen, if you have no further objections, Mr. Mueller stays with us, so we can keep an eye on him. He looked at Harry. I want to make it perfectly clear to you that although you have been detained here, no harm will come to you. We just need to keep you here until Project Green begins. Perhaps 2 or 3 days. Understand? Harry Muller understood that he might be dead in less than 2 or 3 days. But on another level, looking at these men, who in his world of police work were not the murdering type, he thought that Maddox might be telling the truth. He couldn't believe, or make himself believe, that guys like this would go ahead and kill him. He glanced at Lansdale, who seemed like the only one in the room who might actually be dangerous. Mr. Muller, do you understand? Harry nodded. Yeah. Good. Don't let your imagination get the best of you. What you're going to hear in the next hour or so is so far beyond your wildest imagination that you'll forget about yourself anyway. Harry looked at Maddox, who still seemed cool and smart-mouthed, but Harry could also see that Maddox was a little hyper and worried about something. Harry regarded the other four men, and he thought he'd never seen guys who were so powerful looking so worried. The older man, Dunn, the president's advisor, was pale, and Harry noticed that Dunn's hands were trembling. Hawkins, the general, and Wolfer, the defense guy, looked pretty grim. Only Lansdale appeared relaxed, but Harry could see he was putting it on. Whatever was going on here, Harry thought, it was real, and it was something that was scaring the shit out of these guys. Harry took some comfort in the fact that he wasn't the only one in the room who was scared shitless. Chapter 8 Bane Maddox stood and said, I call this emergency meeting of the executive board of the Custer Hill Club to order. Still standing, he continued, Gentlemen, as you know, because of the one-year anniversary of 9/11, the Office of Homeland Security has put the nation on alert level orange. The purpose of this meeting is to decide if we should go ahead with Project Green, which will reduce the alert level to that color, permanently. Maddox looked at Harry. You'd like that, wouldn't you? Sure. Might put you out of a job. That's okay. Good. Now, if the board will bear with me, I'd like to get Harry up and running on this. In fact, we can all benefit from some perspective before we make any decisions. He looked at Harry and asked, You've heard of mutually assured destruction? Yeah. During the Cold War, if the Soviets launched nuclear missiles against us, we would, without debate, launch our arsenal of nuclear weapons against them. Thousands of nuclear warheads would rain down on both countries, assuring mutual destruction. Remember that? Harry nodded. Maddox continued, Paradoxically, the world was actually safer then. No hesitation on our part, and no political debates. This strategy had a beautiful simplicity to it. The radar images of thousands of nuclear missiles headed our way meant we were dead. The only moral question, if any, was, do we kill tens of millions of them before we all die? You and I know the answer to that. But there were fuzzy-headed people in Washington who thought that revenge was not a justification for us destroying a big part of the planet, that no purpose would be served by obliterating the innocent men, women, and children whose government had just assured our obliteration. Well, the doctrine of mutually assured destruction, MAD, removed any such questions by making our response automatic. We didn't have to rely on a president who lost his nerve or had a moral crisis, or who was out playing golf or getting laid somewhere. There were a few polite chuckles. Mr. Maddox continued, The primary reason that MAD worked was that it was unambiguous and symmetrical.
Each side knew that a nuclear first strike by one would set off a counterstrike by the other of equal or overwhelming force, which would destroy the very civilization of both nations. He added, that would leave places like Africa, China, and South America to inherit what was left of the Earth. Pretty depressing, don't you think? Harry remembered how the world was before the collapse of the Soviet Union. Nuclear war was pretty scary, but he never really believed it was going to happen. Maddox seemed to be reading his mind and said, but this never happened, and never would. Even the most insane Soviet dictator could not contemplate this scenario. Despite the rantings of left-wing pacifists and pinhead intellectuals, mutually assured destruction actually assured that the world was safe from nuclear Armageddon. Right? Harry thought, what the hell is this guy getting at? Bain Maddox sat down, lit a cigarette, and asked Harry, have you ever heard of something called wildfire? No. Maddox looked at him closely, then explained a secret government protocol. Have you ever heard these words used in passing, or in any context? No, I wouldn't think so. This secret protocol is known only at the highest levels of government, and by us. And now by you, if you pay attention. Paul Dunn, the presidential advisor, interjected, Bain, do we need to talk about this in front of Mr. Mueller? Bain Maddox stared at Dunn and replied, as I said, this is a good exercise for all of us. Very shortly, we're going to make a decision that will change the world as we know it, and the history of the world for the next 1,000 years. The least we can do is explain ourselves to Mr. Mueller, who represents the nation we say we are going to save. Not to mention explaining ourselves to ourselves at this critical juncture. Lansdale, the CIA man, said to everyone, you have to let Bain run it his way. You should know that by now. Edward Wolfer added, more important, this is a transformative moment in the history of the world, and I wouldn't want Bain or anyone to ever think we didn't give it the time that's equal to its importance. Maddox turned to his old friend. Thank you, Ed. No one may ever know what happened here today, but we know, and God knows. And if someday the world does know, then we need to justify ourselves to God and to man. Lansdale commented dryly, let's not tell God. Maddox ignored him and drew on his cigarette. The first Islamic terrorist attacks began in the 1970s, as you recall. Bain Maddox began with the Munich Olympics massacre, and then rattled off a list of 30 years of airplane hijackings, bombings, kidnappings, executions, and mass murder by Islamic jihadists. The men in the room remained silent, but a few nodded in remembrance of one or another terrorist attack. Harry Mueller, too, recalled almost every attack that Maddox mentioned, and what surprised him was how many there were over the last 30 years. He was surprised, too, that he had forgotten so many of them, even the big ones, like the car bomb attack on the Marine barracks in Lebanon that killed 241 Americans, or the bomb on board Pan Am Flight 103 over Lockerbie that killed hundreds of people. Harry felt himself getting angrier as each attack was chronicled, and he thought that if a terrorist, or any Muslim, were brought into the room, the guy would be ripped apart by everyone there. Maddox knew how to inflame the crowd. In fact, Maddox looked around the table and said, every one of us here had a friend, or knew someone who was killed in the World Trade Center or the Pentagon. He addressed General Hawkins. Your nephew, Captain Tim Hawkins, died in the Pentagon. Next, he spoke to Scott Lansdale. You had 2 CIA colleagues who died in the World Trade Center, correct? Lansdale nodded. Maddox turned to Harry.
And you? Did you lose anyone that day?
Harry replied, My boss,
Captain Stein, and some other guys I knew, died in the North Tower.
My condolences, said Maddox, who then concluded his recitation of the atrocities, brutalities, and violence against America and the West. This was all something new under the sun, and neither the world nor the United States knew how to react. Many people thought it would just go away. Obviously, it did not. It just got worse. In fact, the Western world wasn't equipped to counter these terrorist attacks, and we seemed to lack the will to respond to these people who were murdering us. Even when the United States was attacked on its own soil, the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center, we did nothing. He looked at Harry.
Correct?
Yeah. But that changed things.
I hadn't noticed.
Harry said, Well, 9/11 changed everything. We're more on top of,
you know, Harry, you and your ATTF friends, and the whole FBI, CIA, Defense Intelligence, British MI5 and MI6, Interpol, and the rest of the useless European intelligence services could spend the rest of their fucking lives chasing Islamic terrorists, and it wouldn't make much difference.
I don't know. I know. Last year, it was the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Next year, it will be the White House and the Capitol building. Maddox paused, blew smoke rings, then said,
And one year, it will be an entire American city. A nuclear bomb. Do you doubt that?
Harry didn't reply.
Harry, no, I don't doubt that.
Good.
Neither does anyone at this table. That's why we're here.
He asked Harry, How would you prevent that from happening?
Well, actually, I sometimes work on the NEST team, the Nuclear Emergency Support Team. You know about that?
Bain Maddox smiled.
Harry, you're sitting here with the Deputy Secretary of Defense, a top national security advisor to the President of the United States, a member of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the CIA liaison to the White House. If there's anything we don't know, I'd be very surprised.
Then why do you keep asking me questions?
Maddox seemed a little annoyed. Let me tell you about NEST, known as the Volunteer Fire Department of the Nuclear Age. Very quaint, and about as effective. 1,000 or so volunteers from the fields of science, government, and law enforcement who sometimes disguise themselves as tourists and business people. They walk or drive around American cities and other sensitive targets, such as dams, nuclear reactors, and so forth, carrying their gamma ray and neutron detectors hidden inside briefcases, golf bags, beer coolers, and whatever. Correct?
Yeah.
Did you ever find an atomic bomb?
Not yet. And you never will. There could be an explosive nuclear device or a dirty bomb sitting in an apartment on Park Avenue with the timer going, and the chances of NEST or Harry Mueller discovering that bomb is near zero, correct?
I don't know. Sometimes you get lucky. That's not very reassuring, Harry.
Maddox said, The question is, how does the American government prevent a weapon of mass destruction, specifically a nuclear device planted by terrorists, from obliterating an American city? He looked at Harry and said,
I want you to draw a lesson from the Cold War strategy of mutually assured destruction, and tell me how we can keep terrorists from planting and exploding a nuclear bomb in an American city. This is not a rhetorical question. Answer me, please.
Harry replied, Okay, I guess like with the Russians. If they knew we were going to nuke them, then they wouldn't nuke us.
Maddox replied, True, but the nature of the enemy has changed. The global terrorist network is not like the old Soviet Union. The Soviets were an empire with a government, cities, hard targets, and soft targets, all laid out in a strike plan drawn up by the Pentagon and known to the Soviets. Islamic terrorism, on the other hand, is very amorphous. If an Islamic terrorist organization detonates a nuke in New York or Washington, who do we retaliate against? He stared at Harry. Who? Harry thought a moment. Baghdad. Why Baghdad? How would we know if Saddam Hussein had anything to do with a nuclear attack on America? Harry replied, What difference does it make? One Arab city is as good as the next. They'll all get the message. Indeed, they would. But here's a better plan. During the Reagan administration, the American government devised and put into place this secret protocol named Wildfire. What Wildfire is the nuclear obliteration of the entire Islamic world by means of American nuclear missiles in response to a nuclear terrorist attack on America. How does that sound to you? Harry didn't respond. You can speak freely. You're among friends. Wouldn't you, deep in your heart, like to see Sandland turned into a sea of molten glass? Harry looked around the table, then replied, Yes. Bain Maddox nodded. So there you have it. Harry Mueller, who is an average American in most respects, would like to see Islam eradicated in a nuclear holocaust. Harry Mueller was happy to go along with Maddox's bullshit, and it was just that, bullshit. Right-wing loony fantasy talk that probably gave these guys hard-ons. He couldn't see any connection between what Maddox was saying and what Maddox was able to do. It reminded him of his days in the NYPD Intelligence Division, when he'd interrogate left-wing radicals who talked about world revolution and the rising of the masses, whatever the hell that was. His boss used to call it pinko wet dreams. He looked around the table again. On the other hand, these guys didn't seem like they were jerking themselves off, or jerking him off. In fact, they looked serious about something, and they were important guys. Maddox broke into Harry's thoughts and said to him, How do we get the United States government to put a quick end to terrorism and to this clear and imminent nuclear threat to the American homeland? Well, I'll tell you, the government has to launch Wildfire, right? Harry didn't answer, and Bain Maddox informed him, There are about 70 suitcase-sized nuclear weapons missing from the inventory of the old Soviet Union. Did you know that? Harry replied, 67. Thank you. Did you ever wonder if any of those suitcase nukes has gotten into the hands of Islamic terrorists? We think they have. Well, you're right. They have. I'll tell you something you don't know. Something that fewer than 20 people in the world know. One of those suitcase nukes was discovered last year in Washington, D.C. Not by a NEST team having a lucky day, but by the FBI acting on a tip. Harry didn't respond, but thought about that, and a cold chill ran down his spine. Maddox continued, I'm sure there are a few more suitcase nukes that have been smuggled into the country, probably through our non-existent border with Mexico. He smiled at Harry. There's probably one sitting in an apartment across the street from your office. No, I don't think so. We've swept the area. Well, I'm just making a point. Don't take me literally. The question is, why hasn't a missing Soviet nuclear suitcase bomb been detonated in an American city? Do you think Islamic terrorists would have any moral or ethical qualms about obliterating an American city and killing a million innocent men, women, and children? No. Me neither. and neither does anyone else after 9/11. But I'll tell you why it probably hasn't happened and won't happen. Because for wildfire to be a reliable deterrent, as mutually assured destruction was, it cannot be kept a complete secret. In fact, since the wildfire plan was implemented, the heads of all Islamic governments have been notified by succeeding administrations in Washington that an attack on an American city with a weapon of mass destruction would automatically ensure an American nuclear retaliation against 50 to 100 cities and other targets in the Islamic world. Harry said, "Good." Bain Maddox continued, "As these gentlemen here can attest to, Harry, wildfire is seen by the American government as a very strong incentive for these countries to control the terrorists in their midst, to induce these countries to share information with American intelligence agencies, and to do whatever they need to do to keep themselves from being vaporized. In fact, the tip about the nuke in Washington came from the Libyan government. So, it seems to be working." "Great." Maddox added, "Something like Nest is a pathetic defensive response to nuclear terror. Wildfire is a proactive response. It is a gun to the heads of Islamic countries. A gun that will go off if they fail to keep their terrorist friends from going nuclear. Undoubtedly most, if not all, terrorist organizations have been warned of this by the Islamic governments that harbor, aid, and have contact with them. Whether the terrorists believe this or not is another question. So far they seem to believe it, which is probably why we haven't been attacked by weapons of mass destruction. What do you think, Harry?"
"Makes sense to me."
"Me too. The Islamic governments have also been informed that wildfire is hardwired. That is, no sitting American president can alter or cancel this retaliation against Islam. This keeps our enemies from trying to analyze each president to see if he, or she, has any balls. The president is pretty much out of the equation after a nuke goes off in America. Just like during the Cold War." He turned to Paul Dunn and asked, "Correct?" Dunn replied, "Correct." Maddox looked at Harry. "You seem lost in thought. What are you thinking about?"
"Well, I'm sure somebody in the government thought about this, but wouldn't 50 or 100 nukes in the Mideast kinda fuck up the oil thing?"
A few men smiled, and Maddox grinned as well. He glanced toward Edward Wolfer and said, "The Deputy Secretary of Defense has assured me that there are no oil fields on the target list. No refineries, and no oil shipment ports. They will remain intact, but will come under new management." He smiled.
"I've got to make a living, Harry."
"Yeah, right. But how about the environment and all that? You know, nuclear fallout. Nuclear winter."
"I told you. The answer to global warming is nuclear winter."
"Just kidding.
Look, the effects of 50 or even 100 nuclear explosions detonating across the Mideast have been studied extensively by the government. It won't be that bad." He added, "I mean, for them, it's lights out. But for the rest of the planet, depending on what computer model you like, life will go on."
"Yeah?"
Something else was troubling Harry Muller.
"Well, it's not going to happen anyway because, like you said, if the terrorists know about this, I mean, do you think, or have you heard that they're going to nuke us?"
"I haven't heard anything. Have you?"
"Actually, my colleagues here think that wildfire is such an effective deterrent that the likelihood of an American city being attacked with a nuclear device by Islamic terrorists is very small."
"That's why we have to do it ourselves."
"Do what?"
"We, Harry, the men here in this room, have devised Project Green.
The plan to detonate an atomic device in an American city, which will in turn trigger the wildfire response, which is the nuclear obliteration of Islam. Harry wasn't sure he'd heard correctly and leaned toward Maddox. Maddox made eye contact with Harry and continued, "And the beauty of this is that the government doesn't even have to be certain that the nuclear attack on America has come from Islamic terrorists. There exists a very strong presumption of guilt toward Islamic jihadists, so that conclusive evidence is not required to launch wildfire." "Brilliant, isn't it?" Harry took a deep breath and said, "Are you crazy?" "No. Do we look crazy?" Harry didn't think the other four guys looked crazy, but Maddox was a little nuts. Harry took another deep breath and asked, "You got a nuke?" "Of course we do. Why do you think we're here?" "We actually have four nukes." In fact, Maddox stood, walked over to the black leather suitcase, and patted it. "Here's one of them." Chapter 9. Bain Maddox suggested a short break, during which everyone, except Scott Lansdale and Harry Muller, left the room. Lansdale stood at the end of the table, away from Harry, and they sized each other up. Lansdale said, "Don't even think about what you're thinking about." "I can't hear you. Come closer." "Cut the macho bullshit, detective. The only way you're getting out of here is if we let you out." "Don't bet your silk CIA panties on that." "If you answer a few questions for me, we can work something out." "That sounds like what I used to say to suspects. I was lying, too." Lansdale let that slide and asked, "When Tom Walsh gave you this assignment, what did he tell you?" "He told me to dress warm and save my gas receipts." "Good advice. And thanks for confirming that it was Walsh." He asked, "What were you supposed to do with your digital discs?" "Find a CIA guy and shove them up his ass." "Were you supposed to go to the Adirondack Airport as part of this assignment?" Harry realized that Lansdale was good at what he did. CIA guys were pricks, but they were highly professional pricks. Harry replied, "No, but that's a good idea. I bet I'll find your name on the arrivals manifest." "Harry, I've got more IDs than you have clean socks in your drawer." He asked, "Who else at 26 Fed knows about your assignment?" "How the hell do I know?" "I didn't mention this before, but one of my friends at 26 Fed tells me you were talking to your cube mate, John Corey, in the elevator lobby, and you were carrying a metal suitcase from Tech. Did Corey ask you what you were doing?" "Why don't you go fuck yourself?" Lansdale ignored this suggestion and said, "I'm trying to help you, Harry." "I thought you were CIA. He asked, "Do you want a piece of this, Harry?" "Yeah, sure. I'm with you." "You may not mean that now, but after this is over, you'll see that this was the only way to go." "Don't you have to go take a piss or something?" "No. But here's a question for you to think about. Do you think you might have been set up?" "What do you mean?" "I mean, Walsh was told by somebody, probably in Washington, to send a guy up here, an NYPD surveillance guy, to take pictures of people arriving at this club. It sounds like no big deal, right? But the people who ordered this, and maybe Walsh himself, knew you weren't going to get within a mile of this lodge before you were caught." "I got a lot closer than that." "Congratulations. So, what I'm thinking, Harry, is that you're the sacrificial lamb. Follow?" "No. I mean, this is so clumsy that the only reason you could have been sent here is to scare the hell out of us and make us put Project Green on hold. Or maybe put it on the fast track. What do you think?
I've worked with CIA, and what I think is that you people see a conspiracy in everything, except the things that are a conspiracy. That's why you've been fucking up.
You may have a point.
But let me share my paranoia with you. You were sent here by higher-ups, through Walsh, for the purpose of spooking us into action, or for the purpose of the FBI's getting a search warrant to come looking for you and finding 4 atomic suitcases that they might believe are here.
Harry didn't reply, but he thought about that. Lansdale continued,
Let's assume